Hello, this is Dr. Laura Hannes-Webb of VisionarySoul.com, author of The Gift of ADHD and Listening to Depression, for my new program, The Sweet Spot Podcast. Tune in weekly to find where your passion meets your purpose. This show is committed to helping you find, embrace, and live in your sweet spot. You can find us online at sweetspotpodcast.com or psychjourneypodcast.com. And this week, we'll be talking about how to find intimacy in relationships, which is, of course, an important part of finding the sweet spot in your own life. We'll be talking with Drs. Janae and Barry Weinhold, the authors of The Flight from Intimacy, Healing Your Relationship of Counterdependency, The Other Side of Codependency. Welcome, Barry and Janae.
Hi, Laura.
Hi, Laura.
Well, it's wonderful to have you here. And my first question, I think anyone hearing the title of this is going to want to know. Most of us have heard of codependency. Maybe you can just review what that is and tell us that you're talking about something very different. You're introducing a brand new term, I think, called counterdependency, and tell us what that is.
Counterdependency is like the other side of the coin. In a relationship dynamic, there's usually one person who is craving intimacy and another one who is sort of afraid of it. A lot of people have talked about this craving for intimacy, but no one's really talked about those people who avoid it. And even though they may start out in a relationship and say they want intimacy, it's not very long before we see that person pushing away, becoming very busy, and at some deep level avoiding having that connection that they originally said they wanted.
Huh. And so it's different from codependency, and it's interesting because there's been so much in the literature about how we help people who are codependent. How do we help people who are counterdependent?
It's actually more difficult to help people who are in the counterdependency stuff because they tend to see that there's nothing wrong with them. They have this kind of urge to look good, to show people how successful they are, to make their whole life kind of busy and very functional, where people who are codependent seem to have the other part.
Yeah, we actually discovered this. We were doing a workshop in California, and it was on codependency. And we found that so many people in the workshop were not in relationship. We asked them why, and they said, well, we've been told that the relationships are bad for us, so we stay away from them. And we began to think about that. Why are people so afraid of relationship? And why are people so afraid of intimacy? And then that led us to understand that the other side of codependency, which is often fairly invisible in our culture because our culture itself, our whole way of relating to people, has a lot of counterdependency in it, and it's become so common it's hard to see it.
And so a lot of this language of codependency and counterdependency is tied up with addiction. And that's how a lot of people get introduced to these terms. And you make such an interesting point. You challenge the disease model of addictions, and one of the things that you say is that when you look at the numbers using the disease model, 96 to 98% of the population has at least one addictive disease. Now, when you get to that level, it almost is meaningless. So can you say a little bit about how do you come up with a 96 to 98%, and then what is your alternative to this disease model?
Well, the number grew out of just researching what each of the various addiction groups, like the sex addiction groups, the alcoholics, the codependents, all of the different groups, adding up the numbers that they claim have this disease. And it added up to 96% of the population.
Wow.
So we began to think about even codependency. Our earlier book on codependency called Breaking Free of the Codependency Trap did not adopt that model. We saw codependency, and we also see counterdependency and the flight from intimacy as a developmental issue, not a disease that you never recover from, but one in which you didn't get certain important developmental needs met during childhood, and these keep recycling, particularly in our close relationships.
And so, And so that you also make the point, and this is a powerful one, that that close relationships, that conflict is not a problem with relationships. It's in fact a part of relationships and offers a chance to heal these, what you're, and then I guess the connection between the addictions and the relationship is the addictions are an expression of these developmental traumas or whatever we want to call them, and that intimacy is an opportunity to heal those. Is that right?
Yes, and it's exactly right, Laura. And we discovered this through our own relationship. We were married at midlife, and even though we had a very deep commitment to having an intimate relationship, we kept seeing all these things that interfered with it. And so we began to look at what was causing our own struggle with intimacy, and what we found was a lot of very early trauma, trauma that we had used to mask by different kinds of addictions. We haven't been into the alcohol so much, but we certainly have our, might be classified as workaholics. And we found underneath these addictive behaviors a lot of buried emotions that were related to very early pain. And once we began to deal with the early pain and look at the traumatic events, we found that the closer we got, the more they came up. And that was really surprising because we had this kind of fantasy that if you're really close, you don't have conflict. But the conflicts themselves actually, like, opened the doors to these early traumas. So the closer we got, the more that we found traumas that we had with our mothers, very early things, like even in the first 6 months of our lives where we learn how to relate, you know, through our relationship with our mother. So it's been a really powerful journey of learning and opening ourselves to these very deep and early experiences.
So instead of thinking of conflict as something you should just try to get rid of by being overly nice, you're saying this is almost a marker, and it's saying, hey, this is a place where you need to do a little digging, and you can heal yourself from one of these, whether it be emotions that need to come up or some sort of trauma that could be healed. Can you say some more about that?
Yeah, it's like a doorway that provides opportunities for people to get into the sweet spot, as you call it.
Oh, thank you.
Because it really, when a conflict comes up, it's just an indication that you've touched some area that was previously unhealed or where there was some pain or some hurt, and it provides an opportunity for a couple to work together to heal that, to support each other, to provide the nurturing support that probably people didn't get when they were a child that caused this to become a trauma. We talk about the difference between a trauma and an owie.
Ah.
That in a, as a child has some kind of either physical or emotional hurt, if there's somebody there to comfort them, it's just an owie.
Yeah.
And it gets healed right away. But if there isn't anyone there to do that for them, they either don't understand the emotional stress or problems that the child is having, and they ignore it or they don't address it properly, that becomes more like a trauma. And so those things then will show up again in relationships, in adult relationships, and it provides an opportunity through the conflict for that to get healed.
What we did eventually was we had to just redefine our understanding of intimacy. Because I think we probably, like a lot of people, particularly when we're young, we think that intimacy is all the good times. You know, it's those upbeat kinds of moments where we feel this kind of euphoria, maybe really spiritual kind of connections. And anything that doesn't fit in that category is called not intimacy. But we just call all of that intimacy. And there's actually like two kinds of sweet spots, Laura. There is that kind of upbeat and very expansive kind of connection where we find the sweet spot, but there's also another sweet spot where we go down really, really deep, and in that kind of healing that Barry's talking about, the other sweet spot is one where we have an experience of touching souls. And they're like both part of intimacy, but you go through them, you know, from different kinds of experiences, but the outcome and both of them is that we feel really close, and so it's all intimacy in our way of thinking about it.
Well, it seems really important to broaden it in that way, because as you talk about in the book, why is there such a failure in our culture at this time of relationships. And it may be that if we are so, you know, narrow that we're going to define relationship as only, you know, the high times, the fun, then and then it's inevitable that we're going to come across this conflict. So that by bringing that into intimacy, it helps people to say, okay, well, here we go. We're on the journey to intimacy, rather than saying, oh, this isn't working for me.
Mm-hmm. Right. And unfortunately, so many people, when they get to a conflict, they don't know what to do. They don't have skills. So the book provides a lot of skill-building exercises and activities that help people understand, what do you do when you get to that conflict that comes up, and how do you handle it? So that's, again, another part of the book that we are feel good about. Most of the book actually is about how to recover from this developmental problem called counterdependency, rather than just explaining what it is.
That's right. And so we should come back to some of the specific exercises and techniques for resolving conflicts. But coming back to healing the developmental leap, I know that one of the things you talk about is the importance of self-parenting. And I love, for example, you have the Inner Child Bill of Rights. I don't know if you could talk a little bit about that. I think that's a really good concrete place for people to start.
Well, our experience in working on our own history is that we have a lot of internal parts, and often what we try to do is we put them in a closet and shut the door and put a lock on it. And as we decide that we don't want to live this kind of isolated, lonely life, that's really a lot of what counterdependency is about, we have to bring that child out of the closet and begin to look at what the wounds are and to find other parts. Because along with the wounded child, we also can find a nurturing mother. We can find our connection to God or to some kind of spirit. We can also find helper parts that teach us how to speak up, how to define our needs and to share them with other people, to communicate in effective ways, and to not have this terrible feeling of just being small and without words and unable to present ourselves to the world or to the people around us in a way that says, I had some things that hurt me, and now I want to be a more authentic person. I want to let my child speak and have some of these things from the past not affect me, to not leave me crippled with fear, so I can't say this, or I can't ask for this, or I can't do that, because then people would think that there was something wrong with me, or it would reveal to other people that I'm not perfect, you know, that I have some brokenness. And so opening up the door to find that child is really much more about becoming an authentic person with a real self, rather than this kind of, I don't know, false self. I think that a lot of us in this country have learn to present to the world, I'm fine, you know, when people ask us, how are you doing? Oh, great, no problems. We don't ever really talk about, oh, today I had a little bump, you know. It's not really socially accepted.
That's a good point. And it's so important. I wanted to ask, do you have anything to add, Barry?
Yeah, I think the whole idea that we're trying to get to is that what seems to get people stuck is that there's a fear of feeling their feelings that they had early on. And I can understand to some extent why, because when we felt those feelings originally, when the original developmental trauma happened, there probably was no one there to comfort us. And we had no resources to deal with it. So it was very overwhelming. And so there's a fear of, if I felt those feelings again, boy, I'd get so overwhelmed and so out of control, I wouldn't know what to do. And in fact, what people find out when they're able to do that with the support of their partner is that it's freeing, and it reveals the healing qualities in the relationship, and it brings them closer together, and it provides more intimacy. So it's a doorway, as I said, to that sweet spot that you call in the relationship. And basically, most people then have to connect needs with feelings. What am I needing in this relationship? I'm feeling this. Once I have the feelings out, then I have to think about, well, what am I needing? And to be able to ask for what you need and want directly from your partner is a powerful way of healing. And so many people, once they do that, they find it's much easier than they thought to get to where they want to get and have the intimacy that they want.
Yes, and So that kind of is one strategy for going through those developmental leaps. And as you said, these will come up through the conflict. And what is one, I don't know if there's like one really specific technique that you could give to our listeners that when you're in the middle of a conflict, what's one thing you can do just to kind of put the brakes on or find a way to translate it into a doorway rather than, you know, a slam door, for example?
Well, a really quick and easy tool that we use is looking at an overreaction. If Barry says something and it's a 25-cent comment and I have a 50-cent or a dollar reaction to it, it means that the balance of my reaction is about something from the past. So as soon as I see myself overreacting, I take a little time out and I work on myself. I don't try to, like, keep trying to talk to Barry. I think about, okay, where is this coming from? What did he say that reminded me of something from the past? Or was it the look on his face, you know, or is it the tone of his voice? Does that remind me of my father? And try to connect my overreaction to something in my own history rather than just making my overreaction his problem because he said this or he did or he didn't do. So it's really kind of a retreat into myself to make me responsible for my overreaction.
Oh, so that's a great tip. So if you find, you know, yourself escalating, it could be something like, you know, you get sweaty palms or you find your, you know, rapid breathing or whatever it is in an interaction, say, well, wait a minute, let me just take a time out and see if this is about me rather than the other person, rather than just escalating whatever is the interaction.
Yeah, the typical response is to push the other person away. So you can kind of regulate the internal feeling you're having. Mm-hmm. And there are other ways. If you just take a time out and just focus on what's going on and how you can actually bring yourself back into a state of control of your own emotions and then approach the situation and begin to see that the other person is just a stimulus that's helping me find something in me that I need to now work on and heal.
Mm-hmm. It's sort of like your partner becomes the person who evokes the need for healing. They sort of open the doorway, but then I'm the one that has to walk through it, and I have to figure out what it's about and what in me needs healing. So that's not the other person's responsibility. So there were times when we've worked through this, Laura, where we would say, oh, thank you for bringing me another piece of my healing, and we would roll our eyes and, you know, feel a little miserable, but we really understood that that was what was true.
Well, I can see how that simple shift would be, you know, almost what the world needs now in terms of keeping intimacy and keeping relationships together and families together, in the sense that if we think a conflict is a sign, you know, well, this isn't working, but if we can translate that and say, you know, any conflict we can really use to heal ourselves more deeply, and then once you get into that process, the other person is, you know, such an essential part of your healing that it's more reason for commitment when you have a conflict in some ways.
Yes, and what we found is that people who live alone or have sort of a sheltered life, you know, they have maybe a lot of friendships, but they're not really in a relationship that goes very deep. Those people don't have a lot of conflicts, but they also tend not to grow very much.
Mm-hmm.
So the more relationships that we're willing to say, okay, I commit to you to stay with it through a conflict, the more that we're really able to grow. It's I think, a really deep and intense spiritual path.
Well, we see that the original kind of trauma occurred in relationship, and the healing then has to also occur in relationship.
Oh, wow, that's amazing. And if there's someone that's listening and they're saying, well, you know, that's really interesting about, you know, the healing and the developmental trauma, but what if I'm just at a place where I really want to have more intimacy in my relationships, I want to figure out how to make my relationships work, what advice would you have for someone like that?
Well, I would suggest that they get two or three people where they create a no-exit clause agreement, and they say, let's get to know each other better, and whenever we have conflicts, let's look at them as doorways let's create more intimacy, let's spend more time together, let's talk more about our values and our beliefs and do this deeper kind of exploration. You don't have to be married to people in order to do this kind of work. I have two sisters and two children, and I can, they're like an endless laboratory of working on myself.
That's great. That's a great suggestion that you do need to have this no exit, because it's just too easy to say, huh, I'm disappointed, end game.
That's it, right.
Yeah. Yeah. Or there's something wrong with you, I'm fine, which is pretty much the American way.
Yeah.
And then to kind of shoot from the hip, you know, and walk off and never really look inside.
And we do have a pretty competitive society, and this means we're talking about cooperation here and learning how to cooperate with other people. Americans aren't too good at that. And we have a lot to learn, but we could start by learning how to do that in our relationships.
Well, you even go farther in the book than just saying this is about Americans. You say humanity as a species is stuck in the counterdependent stage of development. Can you say some more about what you mean by that?
Yeah, we look at the whole, take the long view and look at the whole evolution of the human race, you see that it evolved through stages of development. And the early stages in the codependent stage, people were dependent on Mother Nature and Mother Earth. And the beginning of the counterdependent stage of human development was when we put a plow into the ground. And we penetrated Mother Earth with the plow and began to try to control and domesticate animals and control the seasons and everything. And that's sort of where we are at the moment.
A lot of human behavior, but particularly I think American behavior, is very similar to two-year-olds. If you spend time around two-year-olds, a lot of times they're saying, no, you can't make me. we don't want limits. And so there's this resistance to, it's like, I can do it myself. And I think that's kind of a archetypal statement for the human species, since Barry Sibley put the plow in Mother Earth. It was like, well, we don't have to depend on you anymore. We're not hunters and growers. We'll have to just grow it ourselves. And so we started domesticating everything, kind of in his attempt to say, you can't control me anymore. And it's gone really overboard. We're now at the place where we're about to drain this poor planet dry, with all of us showing her that we don't need her anymore. We're about to destroy everything.
This is really what we see as kind of one of the underlying causes of global warming and all of the environmental crisis we're in, is that we've carried this stage much too far. We need to move on. We need to evolve to where we're in more of a cooperative relationship with Mother Earth, and begin to learn how to live on this planet in a more ecological and sustainable way.
Well, that's really a beautiful message for us to end on. In our relationships with each other and our relationships with the Earth, we need to move from domination to cooperation.
Right.
That's really beautiful. Can you tell our listeners where they can find you and what kind of things you offer in terms of books, and where they can find your books and seminars?
Well, our books are all over everywhere. This particular book is published by New World Library. It's available on Amazon and all of the online bookstores. We have a website. It's our last name with an S. It's www.weinholds.org, weinholds.org. We offer a lot of trainings on relationships. We also are consulting, and we do work with people in the child care professions. We do trainings on building sustainable relationships, conflict resolution.
Yeah. All those are part of our life. We're not practicing anymore as psychologists, because we needed the flexibility now to be able to do other things. And when you're tied up with a regular practice, you have to be there every week. And we decided to give that up so we could do other things.
Wow. We'll soon be on YouTube and Google Video and other places where people can get a taste for us in person, without either them or us having to travel.
Well, I'll look forward to finding you in those places. Thank you very much, Janae and Barry.
Well, thank you, Dr. Laura.
Okay, bye.
Bye-bye.